File 24. Once the Pan-Germanists decided to collaborate with Parliament, they were no longer leaders and combatants in a popular movement, but merely parliamentarians. Thus, the movement sank to the common political party level of the day, and no longer had the strength to face a hostile fate and defy the risk of martyrdom. Instead of fighting, the Pan-German leaders fell into the habit of talking and negotiating. The new parliamentarians soon found that it was a more satisfactory, because less risky, way of fulfilling their task if they would defend the new Weltanschauung with the spiritual weapon of parliamentary rhetoric rather than take up a fight in which they placed their lives in danger, the outcome of which also was uncertain, and even at the best could offer no prospect of personal gain for themselves. When they had taken their seats in Parliament, their adherents outside hoped and waited for miracles to happen. Naturally, no such miracles happened or could happen. Whereupon the adherents of the movement soon grew impatient, because reports they read about their own deputies did not in the least come up to what had been expected when they voted for these deputies at the elections. The reason for this was not far to seek. It was due to the fact that an unfriendly press refrained from giving a true account of what the Pan-German representatives of the people were actually doing. According as the new deputies got to like this mild form of revolutionary struggle in Parliament and in the provincial diets, they gradually became reluctant to resume the more hazardous work of expounding the principles of the movement before the broad masses of the people. Mass meetings in public became more and more rare, though these are the only means of exercising a really effective influence upon the people, because here the influence comes from direct personal contact. And in this way the support of large sections of the people can be obtained. When the tables on which the speakers used to stand in the great beer halls, addressing an assembly of thousands, were deserted for the parliamentary tribune, and the speeches were no longer addressed to the people directly, but to the so-called chosen representatives, the Pan-German movement lost its popular character, and in a little while degenerated to the level of a more or less serious club where problems of the day are discussed academically. The wrong impression created by the press was no longer corrected by personal contact with the people through public meetings, whereby the individual representatives might have given a true account of their activities. The final result of this neglect was that the word Pan-German came to have an unpleasant sound in the ears of the masses. The knights of the pen and the literary snobs of today should be made to realize that the great transformations which have taken place in this world were never conducted by a goose quill. No, the task of the pen must always be that of presenting the theoretical concepts which motivate such changes. The force which has ever and always set in motion great historical avalanches of religious and political movements is the magic power of the spoken word. The broad masses of a population are more amenable to the appeal of rhetoric than to any other force. All great movements are popular movements. They are the volcanic eruptions of human passions and emotions, stirred into activity by the ruthless goddess of distress, or by the torch of the spoken word cast into the midst of the people. In no case have great movements been set afoot by the syrupy effusions of aesthetic litterateurs, and drawing-room heroes. The doom of a nation can be averted only by a storm of glowing passion, but only those who are passionate themselves can arouse passion in others. It is only through the capacity for passionate healing that chosen leaders can wield the power of the word, which, like hammer blows, will open the door to the hearts of the people. He who is not capable of passionate healing and speech was never chosen by Providence to be the herald of its will. Therefore, a writer should stick to his ink bottle and busy himself with theoretical questions if he has the requisite ability and knowledge. He has not been born nor chosen to be a leader. A movement which has great ends to achieve must carefully guard against the danger of losing contact with the masses of the people. Every problem encountered must be examined from this viewpoint first of all, and the decision to be made must always be in harmony with this principle. The movement must avoid everything which might lessen or weaken its power of influencing the masses, not from demagogical motives, but because of the simple fact that no great idea, no matter how sublime and exalted it may appear, can be realized in practice without the effective power which resides in the popular masses. Stern reality alone must mark the way to the goal. To be unwilling to walk the road of hardship means only too often in this world the total renunciation of our aims and purposes, whether that renunciation be consciously willed or not. The moment the pan-German leaders, in virtue of their acceptance of the parliamentary principle, moved the centre of their activities away from the people and into Parliament, in that moment they sacrificed the future for the sake of cheap momentary success. They chose the easier way in the struggle, and in doing so rendered themselves unworthy of the final victory. While in Vienna, I used to ponder seriously over these two questions, and I saw that the main reason for the collapse of the pan-German movement lay in the fact that these very questions were not rightly appreciated. To my mind, at that time, the movement seemed chosen to take in its hands the leadership of the German element in Austria. These first two blunders, which led to the downfall of the pan-German movement, were very closely connected with one another. Faulty recognition of the inner driving forces that urge great movements forward led to an inadequate appreciation of the part which the broad masses play in bringing about such changes. The result was that too little attention was given to the social problem, and that the attempts made by the movement to capture the minds of the lower classes were too few and too weak. Another result was the acceptance of the parliamentary policy, which had a similar effect in regard to the importance of the masses. If there had been a proper appreciation of the tremendous powers of endurance always shown by the masses in revolutionary movements, a different attitude towards the social problem would have been taken, and also a different policy in the matter of propaganda. Then the centre of gravity of the movement would not have been transferred to the Parliament, but would have remained in the workshops and in the streets. There was a third mistake, which also had its roots in the failure to understand the worth of the masses. The masses are first set in motion, along a definite direction, by men of superior talents. But then these masses, once in motion, are like a flywheel, inasmuch as they sustain the momentum and steady balance of the offensive. The policy of the pan-German leaders in deciding to carry through a difficult fight against the Catholic Church can be explained only by attributing it to an inadequate understanding of the spiritual character of the people. The reasons why the new party engaged in a violent campaign against Rome were as follows. As soon as the House of Habsburg had definitely decided to transform Austria into a Slav state, all sorts of means were adopted which seemed in any way serviceable for that purpose. The Habsburg rulers had no scruples of conscience about exploiting even religious institutions in the service of this new state idea. One of the many methods thus employed was the use of Czech parishes and their clergy as instruments for spreading Slav hegemony throughout Austria. This proceeding was carried out as follows. Parish priests of Czech nationality were appointed in purely German districts. Gradually, but steadily pushing forward the interests of the Czech people before those of the Church, the parishes and their priests became generative cells in the process of de-Germanization. Unfortunately, the German-Austrian clergy completely failed to counter this procedure. Not only were they incapable of taking a similar initiative on the German side, but they showed themselves unable to meet the Czech offensive with adequate resistance. The German element was accordingly pushed backwards, slowly but steadily, through the perversion of religious belief for political ends on the one side, and the jack of proper resistance on the other side. Such were the tactics used in dealing with the smaller problems. But those used in dealing with the larger problems were not very different. The anti-German aims pursued by the Habsburgs, especially through the instrumentality of the higher clergy, did not meet with any vigorous resistance, while the clerical representatives of the German interests withdrew completely to the rear. The general impression created could not be other than that the Catholic clergy as such were grossly neglecting the rights of the German population. Therefore, it looked as if the Catholic Church was not in sympathy with the German people, but that it unjustly supported their adversaries. The root of the whole evil, especially according to Schirner's opinion, lay in the fact that the leadership of the Catholic Church was not in Germany, and that this fact alone was sufficient reason for the hostile attitude of the Church towards the demands of our people. The so-called cultural problem receded almost completely into the background, as was generally the case everywhere throughout Austria at that time. In assuming a hostile attitude towards the Catholic Church, the pan-German leaders were influenced not so much by the Church's position in questions of science, but principally by the fact that the Church did not defend German rights as it should have done, but always supported those who encroached on these rights, especially the Slavs. George Schirner was not a man who did things by halves. He went into battle against the Church because he was convinced that this was the only way in which the German people could be saved. The Los von Rom, away from Rome, movement seemed the most formidable, but at the same time most difficult method of attacking and destroying the adversary's citadel. Schirner believed that if this movement could be carried through successfully, the unfortunate division between the two great religious denominations in Germany would be wiped out, and that the inner forces of the German Empire and nation would be enormously enhanced by such a victory. But the premises, as well as the conclusions in this case, were both erroneous.